And as I kissed him goodbye, I remember telling him, I promise you I'm going to give your daughter a life that you would have given her and a life you'd be so proud of and one that's magical for her despite what this horror is right now. You know, I remember kissing him goodbye and I said, I'm so sorry I couldn't save you. But all I know to do is give her a life worth living.
Hello, friend. I'm so grateful that you're here. You're listening to Your Spin Out is Gorgeous, a podcast of communion, a place where we connect within the full spectrum of humanity. My name is Natalie Q, and I'm your host. I'm a mother, a lover, a friend, and your fellow human. What I want to offer you is liberation from the cultural foists, the narratives that are thrust upon us and guide much of our experience here on the planet. I'm with you on your journey of unlearning. What if everyone you knew was pursuing a life of whole self-integration, witnessing and offering thanks for all that they are, warts and all? That's not just self-care. That's true, unconditional self-love. And I want to be there with you as you set your life and all the things that aren't serving you alight. With you as you bravely consider life from another perspective. Let's explore all things humanity without the veneer, together. Life examined, not just the pretty parts. You in? Let's do this. Hello, hello, hello. Thank you so much for joining me again. We are back to the heart and soul and ethos of this podcast this week with a very story-based podcast. We've been talking ad nauseum here about different traumas, religious trauma, childhood trauma, intergenerational trauma, trauma bonds. But what about someone who is so immersed in these topics? A doctor who is a criminologist specializing in trauma and victimization. She has 30 plus academic publications about homicide and sexual assault survival. She is a media expert and a television commentator and an advocate for families impacted by violence. And what if from this very academic perspective, she was wholly unprepared for her own immersive experience within this topic when she became a widow at the age of 34, when her 44-year-old husband not only suddenly and unexpectedly passed, but also very visually and violently in front of her child, and her own healing would have to then be commenced personally, but also within her family and her child. It was such an honor to speak with Dr. Ashley Wellman about this really, for me personally as well, like this is, I'm a student of this. I'm fascinated and intrigued and scared and, you know, the full range and full spectrum for me on this topic. I also am a teacher of this topic in a way that I have never personally yet been impacted. God willing, I won't be. But Ashley's story really highlights the chasm between study of a topic and experience of a topic, especially something so impactful in our lives as loss, grief, death, etc. I hope that in this episode, you will learn, you will grow, you will grieve, you will mourn, you will empathize, and so many more things that I couldn't possibly imagine what this experience may be like for you or how it will personally touch or impact you. I just know that it will. And I would love to hear from you, as would Dr. Ashley Wellman. So please connect with us after. But with no further ado, here is Dr. Ashley Wellman in her own words. Ashley, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you for having me, Natalie.
It's my pleasure. Okay, so we're just going to get right in because there's so much to get to about your story and what you've experienced and the way that's informing you today, what you're experiencing today. But let's just go back to that moment of meeting Buddy.
Absolutely. Okay. So that's one of the highlights of my life. When I met Buddy, I was a grad student who was working multiple jobs. I had just gotten out of an abusive relationship, and I really probably wasn't in a space where I needed to be dating. So I was at work one day. I was actually tutoring some football players at the big university that we were both working at. And he walked into the copy room, and all I could think was, my God, he's beautiful. And I walked up to him and I hugged him, which is, if anyone knows me, is not abnormal. And he would recall it to friends later on that it was the longest, most awkward hug he had ever been privy to. And it was one of those, you know, like when you hug someone and you pat them to say like, that's enough. I just didn't pick up on that cue. And I just kept hugging him for some reason. And it was funny because he said, I went back to my office and I thought, she's weird and I like her. And I think I'm going to ask her on a date. And so he actually friend requested me first on Facebook. And he saw me in the hall one day and he said, hey, you know, I sent you a friend request. And I said, oh, I know. I'll accept it if you're lucky. And so I was playing a little hard to get. And then he was just way too cute. So he asked me to go to dinner with him. And I picked a Friday, which was actually April 30th of 2010. And after our date that night, he called his mom and said, I found the woman I'm going to marry. And she said, awesome, you have nothing else going on in your life. So good luck with that. And we did 1 year later on April 30th, 2011, we got married.
Wow. You are bold because you're 10 years younger than him, right?
I was. Yeah. So when we started dating, I was 26 and he was 36. It was funny because the first couple of dates, he would not tell me how old he was. Anyone who met us would be like, oh, cute. She's older than you. He looked far younger than I did. Wow. And so, yeah, but 10 years older.
Wow. That's so cool. I don't think I was that bold at that age. I'm not even sure if I'm that bold now. So I'm impressed. And it sounds like it just has all of the makings of like a serendipitous, beautiful, magical love story. And you're working together. Your careers are intersected. Your love life. You sound like the best of friends. And it was just a beautiful relationship, especially post this domestic violence and kind of difficult relationship that you had left. And that's not normal either, right?
No. And so I remember another thing. I remember once I said, you know, what's wrong with you? Something's got to be wrong with you. And he said, well, I'm indecisive. And that didn't seem like anything that should derail me. And then we were sitting in a restaurant about 2 weeks into dating. I said, you really should not date me because I'm going to move. You know, I was getting my PhD. You don't teach where you get your PhD. So I knew I'd be moving across the country somewhere. And he said, that's okay if it doesn't scare you. I'm going to move wherever you want to move so that I can be, you know, your partner. And I went, oh my God. So it was definitely the start of an amazing life. And we did exactly that. We got married April 30th, 2011. I was finishing my PhD right then. And so he gave up his dream job at the University of Florida and followed me on my kind of academic journey. And my academic journey was something that for anyone who's gotten a PhD, that tenure track, academic job, publications, guest speaking, you know, teaching. It was really one of those kind of whirlwind, if I'm going to go for it, I'm going to go for it big and be super successful in that. And that's kind of what I did with him by my side. In 2014, we had our little girl, Reagan. She was healthy, happy, just a perfect start of kind of a new life, together, being a mom and dad and not just husband and wife. And that was in 2014. A couple years later, we decided to try for a second baby, and we would realize that that first easy try was not going to be replicated. We suffered through four miscarriages back to back to back to back. And it really took me to a dark place. And, you know, my husband had said, he said, you know, I lost the girl that I loved. You're sad, you know, all the time. And I want to get you back. So one of the things we decided was my work was not making me happy at the institution I was at. And maybe a change of scenery, maybe, you know, a change of pace of life would be good for us, both stress-wise and kind of mental health-wise. And so in that moment, we decided to, as a family, move again for my career. I was tenured at the university I was at. I had met some colleagues at a conference who said, you know, Ash, I know tenure is like the end all be all of work, But if you would risk that and come to our university, you know, like, we could get you back on that path to this tenure track job. And, you know, like, I know it's a big risk, but your qualifications kind of set you up for that, you know, next tenure track job. And so we jumped, we took a big risk. I turned down an R1 associate professor job, and we did. He said, your happiness is the goal, not your career. You know, like, your happiness is the goal for our family. And so we did, we moved to Texas, and he had to stay behind and work. And then he got to join us. He got to join us at the end of July of 2018. And I had no idea, no way of knowing that our life would completely change about 2 weeks later, the first day before I started classes.
Mm-hmm. I know what's coming, and I'm already getting emotional.
You know how you plan? I don't know if you're like this, but I'm a planner. I've known when I was going to get married. I knew how many kids I was going to have. We were going to have a family of four. That wasn't working for me. I was going to be super successful in my job. That had worked, but it hadn't brought the joy that I thought it was going to bring. So I said, okay, we've got this new path, a new start. I remember we have this video of him coming home to our Texas condo that we were renting. And my daughter is running out on the porch. He surprised her by coming home, you know, a couple of days early. He was finally getting to join us. And she said, Daddy, do you have to go home? You know, do you have to go back to Missouri? And he said, I'm never leaving. I'm never leaving. And so that was probably the very end of July. August 12th was the day before I started my new job. And he was watching Tiger Woods in some golf tournament. I could never understand golf. He loved it. And I could never understand the hype around Tiger Woods. And he loved him. And he said, oh, Tiger's going to win this tournament. I know Tiger's going to win this tournament. And I said, we are not watching golf all day, right? And he's like, no, you don't have to. You should take a nap because you start a new job tomorrow, you know? And he's like, Mama, run upstairs and take a nap. So I did. I kissed him goodbye. My daughter was in his lap. I went upstairs to take a nap. And it wasn't 3 minutes. I had just gotten into some pajamas and jumped in bed, and glass shattered downstairs. And like any mom does, you know, like, rage instantly filled me. And I was like, what did you break? I screamed downstairs in this little condo. I said, you know, Reagan, what did you break? That's my daughter. And she didn't respond. And I said, Reagan, what did you break? No response. And then I said, Buddy, what did she break? No response. And I knew right then something was really wrong. So I ran downstairs, and before I could get down the stairs, I could see his body lying in the hallway between the guest bathroom and the kitchen, and he was seizing. And I ran down and grabbed him, and he was so cold and like shaking, and he wasn't breathing. He was just like, he looked terrified and he wasn't breathing. And so I just started screaming, and I ran upstairs to get my cell phone. I'm calling 911. And in that time, my 4-year-old child has walked over, you know, and she sees her daddy on the floor, and she's just screaming like, please save my dad, help my daddy. And the mom in me at the moment felt so trapped in this. I couldn't help my child who was crying out for her best friend. And I couldn't help him because I didn't know what to do. And so the 911 operator kept telling me to calm down, you know, is he breathing? And I couldn't tell because he would gasp and then he would stop breathing. And then he would open his eyes and gasp again and stop breathing. And so I just kept screaming like, please get here, please get here. And I remember the fire truck and the ambulance passed our condo. And I ran out in the middle of the street just screaming for them to come back. And they come in and they tell me to please get my daughter and, you know, get her and the dog out of the house. So we go out to the front steps of our condo. We have nobody there. I was trying to call every colleague I could think of. You know, we had only been in town a couple months, and no one was answering their phone. So I just kept calling and calling. And I kept saying, is he okay? Is he okay? And I said, yeah, he has a heartbeat. He's okay. He's going to be okay. You know, just keep your daughter calm and he's going to be okay. And so I was trying to think like, okay, when he wakes up, I'm going to tell him like, you, you know, you insert curse word. Mm-hmm. Don't you ever do that to me again. Right. Because I mean, he was just the light of our world. And then all of a sudden a fire truck and another ambulance come up and these men just run and you can tell there's something, you know, really wrong. And I said, is he still breathing? Is he still breathing? Does he have a heartbeat? And they wouldn't answer me. And I think the third time a guy ran by me, I literally grabbed onto his uniform and I said, is he, you know, does he have a expletive heartbeat? Yes or no? And the man said, no, he doesn't. And I knew right then that this was not going the way that I had, you know, thought in my head. And someone came and got Reagan, and I drove behind the ambulance to the emergency room. And for some reason, they let me in to the emergency room with him. And I'm standing there, and I had gone from being panicked to being this like cheerleader. I was in cheerleader mode. Like, listen, you have two girls at home. You are strong. You are young. You have got to get through this. I need you. I cannot do this by myself. And, you know, I was like, oh, this is going to be good. And they got him back four different times. They got his heart rate back four times. And I knew, I was like, okay, we're going to do this together. And then the CPR continued for 60 minutes. And finally the doctor looked at me and she said, stop. It's enough. And I looked at her like, what in the world? And she said, if he comes back, he is going to be brain dead and we're not doing this anymore. And I said, well, you know, Buddy and I had talked a lot about death and a lot about what we wanted at the end of our lives, thinking, you know, 80 or 90, here he is 44 and healthy. And I knew he would not want that. And I told them, you know, then stop. And in that moment, everything that had been strong and cheerleader about me just collapsed. I couldn't stand up by myself. And I just thought, like, what in the world? This is not real life. They pronounced him dead. And then, you know, they told me I could say goodbye to him. And then it was kind of like, okay, you know, be on your way. It was say goodbye to him and go. And I don't think anything can prepare you for that.
No, I don't think it the first time you told me this, it reminded me of Joan Didion's A Year of Magical Thinking, where she describes this moment that this happened to her. And he was quite a bit older, but it was still her husband in a sudden death. And he's having a cocktail and he seizes as well. And she thinks he's joking. Yeah. And then it goes through very sort of similar to yours. And then just that moment that you leave and you go home to this empty
house. What am I going home to?
Yeah, so changed. Mm-hmm. Who even am I now? I mean, it must be like a moment of like complete, not just the loss of Buddy, but your own identity, because who are you? You woke up that morning with a husband watching golf, you know, thinking you're going to start your new job. And a couple hours later, you have lost the most precious thing in the world to you besides your daughter, and your life will never be the same. And it's almost, I'm sure even 2 years later, unfathomable. Like it's brain explosion trying to comprehend it.
Yeah, it seems like a nightmare. And you know, I have a different perspective of the, you know, the entirety of our love and everything like that. But that moment, it seemed like this is not happening. This is somebody else's life. I didn't feel inside my own body. And as I kissed him goodbye, I remember telling him, I promise you, I'm going to give your daughter a life that you would have given her and a life you'd be so proud of. And one that's magical for her, despite what this horror is right now. You know, I remember kissing him goodbye and I said, I'm so sorry I couldn't save you. But all I know to do is give her a life worth living. And I remember promising him that and then walking out to the car, like, why, God, did you leave me? You know, he was such a good dad. He was such a good man. He was so funny. And anyone who knows me knows I'm an anxious mess. I'm very serious. You know, I take things way too seriously. And, you know, I've come to learn one of the roles I am is I'm a great mother. But in that moment, I remember thinking, like, why would you leave me? You know, I used to be kind of the one that would tease him and say, I would literally tell him I could disappear and you guys would be so great. And he's like, nah, you're cute or you're fun. We'll keep you, you know, but it really was our running joke. Like you know, he was the heart of our home and our family. And like you said, I had walked, you know, I'd walked upstairs that day as this, you know, academic who was starting a new job. And I, you know, that was so important to me. I was a mom who was not a single mother. And I was a wife. And I think I was born to be a wife. I mean, that is a role that was so natural to me, to be a partner. And it was gone in that moment. And I remember my daughter came home from the person who was keeping her. And she had said, you know, like, oh, I brought a toy home for daddy. You know, like, where is he? The doctors helped him, right? And I had to tell her, you know, daddy's not here. Daddy passed away, daddy died. And, you know, unfortunately I had studied grief and trauma as a scholar, and I had no concept of what it meant like as a human being, you know, like as a mother and as a person, who wasn't behind, you know, the title of a professor. And, all I knew to do at the time was do exactly what I had told, you know, the people I had worked with in research and things like that. And I knew, tell her the truth. And so I told her, you know, daddy's heart didn't make it. And, you know, he passed away. He's dead. He's not coming back. And I just remember her little 4-year-old body just wailing and wailing and begging for her dad. And I don't think that stopped for 4 or 5 months after he passed away.
That is so difficult to think through your own grief and your own loss and your own psychology and the way that you begin to, through the grieving process, accept this event as something into your life. But I don't know how we do that as mothers. You know, it's one thing for ourselves, right? But for our children, of whom we would have just wanted this idyllic childhood of mom and dad are there and nothing bad could happen to our children. And we just can't spare them that.
And also,
we want to. Well, go ahead.
Yeah, I think the fact that she witnessed it was an added layer of difficulty and trauma for both of us. One of the things I did right away, I knew I could not do it by myself. I hadn't signed up to do it by myself. I didn't have the strength to do it by myself. And I needed help. And I went directly to a grief center here in Texas, which is heavenly. They're amazing. It's called The Warm Place, and it's designed specifically for children who have experienced death in their family. And I told them, I said, I need your help. My daughter needs your help. I knew that I needed to grieve independently as a mother. I very quickly got into EMDR therapy to have, you know, the visions and the PTSD and those kinds of moments when I was at home. You got to remember, I was new in the city. Yeah. I was in this condo where he had passed away. I was stuck in a lease there. And so at night, you know, when I'd be watching Survivor or The Bachelor or whatever with my best friend, or brushing my teeth and like tickling him, you know, like while we're brushing our teeth, I was by myself and the silence was deafening. And I remember, you know, I would close my eyes or I would walk past that hallway and it just was all back, you know, right. Like I was in the moment again. So EMDR therapy was a lifesaver for me. And I made it a point for Reagan to see my pain and my sadness, in moderation, that she would see me hurt, she would see me cry, she would see me struggle, so that she would know it's okay to hurt and struggle too. I think that's been one of our best, you know, best part of our relationship is that we're both very vulnerable with one another, and she's been, you know, a partner with me. I've treated her like, you know, she's children understand. They know things, even though we'd like to pretend that they don't. And another thing that I really tried to do in that moment was reach for something maybe that wasn't what my normal routine was, you know, because everyone expects you kind of just to go back to normal, and there's no normal. So a colleague of mine, I think, saved my life. He said he saw a picture of my daughter dancing with her posable skeleton. It was a picture of my office. And he laughed one day and he said, you know, you should write a children's book about your daughter and the way that she's dancing with a skeleton. And so at night I would be working on this children's book or eventually this teen novel that I was writing. And creative writing had been something for like 15 years I had not ventured into at all. I was a scholar, and you really, you know, you write very seriously. And I remember my advisor back in grad school saying, like, Ash, you got to let go of the fluff and the prettiness of your writing. You got to write like a scholar. And I really just kind of said, like, no, I'm going to go back to my roots and kind of express myself through art and writing, and those sorts of things. Art became a really big part of Reagan's healing too. She entered a audition-based art school. And so I think the music and the, you know, painting and those kinds of things really did serve as therapy for us. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't fully understand that not everyone can kind of see the full picture. I knew not everyone can handle grief and emotions, but I think to live it is very different. I think for colleagues that I was working with, some of them viewed my grief as not the path they would take. You know, if I was joyful and happy at an event because I hadn't been out of the house in 3 months, something was wrong with that because I shouldn't be happy. But then if I was crying one day, there would be a note of concern that if I'm crying and, you know, months from now that they would, you'd be very worried about me. And so there was a lot of kind of
point there's probably much more to it about different people's expectations of you and how you grieve and how you also bring your grief into your responsibilities at work, or that there's a different connections and threads to people who Buddy's parents or people close to him versus if they didn't know him, managing their grief, I think is something that people sometimes bring up, is like having to be strong for other people who are grieving. Like the layers of it are we ask a lot of people.
I didn't want to be strong for other people. In hindsight, I probably could have actually handled that better. I tried so hard to be graceful and, cognizant, but at the same time, like I didn't know how to get out of bed. You know, I said, I will get out of bed, you know, like every day I said, like, it's a feat that I got out of bed. I brushed my teeth, you know, I put pants on and I'm getting my daughter to school. That was so much emotional and physical energy, mm-hmm. that, you know, and then you got to keep in mind, no one else had to hear and listen to Reagan's grief too. So when they would say, you know, oh, we're hurting too, I wouldn't wish losing anyone on my worst enemy. I would not. But the pain of Reagan consistently layered with my grief made it almost unbearable. Do you know what I mean? Where I was like, I will not let her not be healthy. I will make sure that my daughter is healthy and happy. That was my promise to my, you know, to my husband. But in that, you know, in that same thing, no one else can understand what it's like to have her wake up in the middle of the night with nightmares, or, you know, recall that event, or, you know, ask me on the way to school, like, why don't I have a daddy anymore? Or sit in the middle of a movie theater and every Disney movie is about a dead parent. And I had never noticed that until, you know, he passed away and we're in a movie and, you know, every single one, it's like, oh, and, you know, I think Reagan's empathy is beautiful now because she does know what pain and hurt and people not understanding feels like. But I hate that she knows that, you know, and so then, like, you know, I'm trying to be patient and understanding of other people's grief, but it's also, you know, I also needed, you know, it would have been amazing to have more people around. I will tell you, I had friends from all over the country who, it was funny because at one point I was like, they said, you know, are you tired of us coming? I said, yes, but no, keep coming. Because it was like every weekend I had friends or family in town. And I think as much as I thought I hated it in the moment, you know, because I was like, I need time by myself, I probably didn't, you know? Mm-hmm. And the person who's, you know, my dearest friend here today, I would be lost without him, was one of the only people locally that would, you know, he'd come by and say like, hey, Ashley, you got to get out of the house. Let's go get lunch. Or have you eaten today? You know, and we'll get up, we're going to go get some food, you know, or let's go have a glass of wine or something and talk to me about how you're feeling. And he was the only one who wasn't, scared of the emotion, you know, I would be in the middle of a bar having a glass of wine, you know, and I'd have a full mental breakdown.
Yeah.
And he would talk to me as if we're watching a sports game, you know? And I think finding someone who is safe, in a way that you're not asking too much out of them by being vulnerable and very transparent with your grief, that was something that really did get me through it, was finding the one person, good, bad, ugly, I could really share my feelings with.
You highlighted a couple of interesting points to marry with that, which is when you talked about studying this from an academic perspective, it was still not ever the same as what you experience going through it. And I think that's all of us. Death has not really touched me that close. You know, you have a pet die, or I've had a few surprising friends die young, or, you know, people that I've known or some grandparents, but nothing like this, where it would be a full-on life-changing, life-altering event, someone like a spouse or a child or even my parent. I haven't had my parents die either. So I don't understand it either when someone is going through it. And we've talked a lot on this podcast through childhood trauma and different things about the way that it's more likely that we have no formal education like you had in emotions or psychology or grief or the grieving process. And then we've also not had an experience. And so then when a friend is going through it, how do we know how to be that friend? And where could we, how could we change as a culture to be more open to, in the childhood trauma, by the way, what I'm meaning is that if we've had childhood trauma where our parents stifled our emotions, that's where that's coming from, that we can't handle our own emotions and other people's big emotions. Mindful Maloku, Adita Maloku is my guest that I had on for the childhood trauma episode, which is really good. If you haven't listened, go listen to it, as she's talking about the way that we're raised as people through like our empathy centers. If you're having these big childhood emotions and your parents shame you for those, that's going to feel normal to all of us, which is why we then want to do that to other people when they're grieving. Oh, you've got these big emotions. Let me shame you, which also is so beautiful about what you're doing with your daughter, because that's the exact opposite of that parenting that was more common for us, of not only are your big emotions as a child something to stifle and don't do that, and that upsets me, and you know, now I'm making you responsible for my emotions, but then our parents didn't show us their emotions either, which then made emotions seem bad or something to hide or something shameful. So you really are lucky with this friend, and your daughter is very lucky for that education that you're giving her in the grieving process and in the managing of emotions process and in the being honest with yourself and your emotions. So
I think there is a way for, you know, I don't know how to talk to another widow who lost a 44-year-old husband to a pulmonary embolism with a 4-year-old. You know, I don't know what her grief is like, because our grief is so personal and it's so tied to what our life experiences are, what our relationship was like, you know, those types of things. And so I don't even pretend to know with another widow, you know, newly single mom with a sudden death. I don't pretend to know how to, you know, explain her grief. But I think one of the things that feels so good to hear is just that this is unfair. This stinks. I don't know what to say. I'm here for you. I love you. What can I do for you? And mean it. You know, even better than asking what can I do for you is just do, you know, send something to alleviate pressure in life. So if the person might need, you know, food or don't ask, just bring it. And if I have too much food, we'll freeze it, you know. But
that makes a lot of sense, because the bandwidth, you don't want to sit there and be going, am I hungry? Am I not? You're just like literally spoon to mouth.
You don't want to think. I remember cleaning people showed up at the condo and I went, hello? And they're like, yeah, your friends sent us. We're going to clean your house. And I was like, you are? Okay. And I walked out and I just kind of sat in my car. I think I cried. And I was like, well, that was nice. Mm-hmm. You know, and just things like that. But you know, we're conditioned to say things like, oh, it's God's plan. Oh, it's part of this. Well, it wasn't part of my story. So that doesn't comfort me. I do know that it's part of God's story because God brought him to me. And I know that I had the most beautiful chapter of my life because I was allowed to have that relationship with him. And I was given the most precious gift in life. So like, I know God's written all over that. But let me tell you what, when it comes to those 90 minutes and the fact that the rest of my life has been completely altered, I don't want to hear that that was God's plan or that he's in a better place, because I guarantee you Buddy Wellman fought kicking and screaming to get out of heaven. I guarantee you he was like, do not take me here right now. I'm not ready. So the better place was at home with us. And so, you know, there's these kind of colloquialisms and these like, you know, generic things we say to people of like, oh, I understand. You don't.
Mm-hmm. And not everybody's religious or even spiritual either. Yeah. There are atheists who are in grief who are truly believing that there is no afterlife, and there's no amount of you proselytizing to them that there is, that you can lend some faith to them, because I've lived that reality too.
Right.
And that would be so offensive for you to tell me, my husband that I loved dearly and wanted to live this life with is with a God I don't believe in. I mean, that would just be bizarre.
Be hard. And then, you know, there's different faiths. So like, mm-hmm. I'm a different faith than his family was. And both beautiful faiths, I have so much respect for it. But that takes on two very different, you know, end results and things like that. But then you have, you know, other people. Like, my family is incredible. I have the best family. But my dad's a Marine. Very much no emotion. The older he's gotten, the softer he's gotten. Don't tell him I told you that, but like super emotional now. He's very sensitive now. But you know, growing up, like you said, not a whole lot of emotions, with those kinds of things. But, you know, one of his things was like, Ashley, you're a single mom now. Like, you got to get it together. We got to go, you know, this is business. Like, what's the next business thing we got to do? Like, you need to get his death certificate. And he was doing the best he knew how to do. And that's what everyone was doing in the moment, the best they knew how to do. But and, you know, for people going, what could I do? There is no right thing to say, except it's just not fair. This just stinks. You know, what can I do? I'm here. And when people do have big emotions, you don't have to know how to handle them. Just love them. That's mm-hmm. it. Instead of the judgment. Because the way you think you're going to grieve may not be the way you'd grieve if you were faced with that. And there is no right way. We've been conditioned to, like, death is taboo. Grief is taboo. Crying's taboo. I cried and my emotions were so big because I lost something so great to me. The cost of admission to life is loss, and it's a big cost. You know, that's a big expensive cost. And so I think for me, the only thing I really could do is kind of thrust myself back into my career. And I remember the day after he passed away, I was like, I'm still going to be in class the first day. You know, I'm going to be there. I'm going to tell my students what happened, because that was something I could control, you know. And thank God a couple of people were like, no, you're not. We're not going to do that.
You know? Can you imagine showing up to class, your first day of class, like, hey, everyone, just moved here. My husband died yesterday. Yeah. Here's the syllabus. Like, are you kidding me?
Have a good job. I wanted to so bad, Natalie. So I was like, okay, fine. I'll take four weeks, because that's what the initial plan was. But I wrote up like 14 pages line by line, week one, you know, of what this person filling in for me would do. And so luckily I got this bereavement leave. I was able to kind of transition and not so much focus on the heavy work I was doing as a victimologist, which was a blessing. What I think happened though was that lost in translation happened. You know, my bereavement leave became viewed more as a break for me, because what I showed in the office was someone who was trying to be creative and thrive and, you know, not cry as much, because, you know, I had been told that that was disturbing, and I was singing Christmas carols one time and that upset a colleague. And, you know, it's like, I couldn't do it right, but I was trying to lead with, you know, joy and, what other people would be comfortable with. And so, that job that we had moved for came open in January, right when I had come back to work. And I was like, this is it. This is it. You know, everything I've promised my husband, everything, getting his daughter into a school that we had literally picked out before we moved here, and getting, our house. You know, I was about to close on a house, which he would have just loved. And this job had come open, and I'm like, this is it. This is literally the three things that we moved to Texas for, you know? And, I had no idea that there was actually a plan to not only, I wasn't going to get the job, but to exclude me from the search. And I think a lot of that resulted from this kind of divergence from what was expected societally and what wasn't seen on the surface. Credit not really being given to how much I had been able to accomplish as a grieving widow. You know, I was the top researcher that year. I was the top teacher, one of the top teachers that year. And all of that, I think, was explained away because I had been at home, you know? Mm-hmm. And the heartbreak that surrounded, I would learn, you know, in September from a phone call that I wasn't getting a phone interview, for an entry-level job, mind you. I've been in this career for many, many years, and done a lot of big things in this career. It was more heartbreaking than the death of my husband. And when I say that, it's so sick to say that my job would be so much more hurtful than the death of my spouse. And so, if I look at my life with Buddy and saying goodbye to him, I couldn't control it. That whole chapter of my life is painted in love and grace and beauty and so many valuable conversations that, you know, no other young spouses have about cremation and, you know, what do you want when you die? What would you want me to do about loving, you know, like somebody else and those kinds of things. We had both talked about that. But this job, by not getting this, this was who I was. I was a scholar. I was a researcher. I was a media expert. I was a, you know, police and victim advocate, all centered around my PhD. And I think in that moment, I felt worthless, I felt valueless, and I felt lost. And I didn't have the energy to feel those things, mm-hmm. given what I had been through, you know, miscarriages, that the death of my husband. You know, I just kept going like, what else? Like, I don't know. And I should never ask that because there's always other things. But
it's such an interesting highlight of like the lack of humanity for some of these events. You know, pregnancy would be another one, or yeah. the humanity of like the years of kind of maybe turmoil psychologically leading up to a divorce, or the moment of divorce that can sort of derail a career because we don't have space within these systems, yeah. death, grief in this way as well, for people to be human.
Right.
And it's inhumane. Go ahead.
I think it can be too vulnerable, you know, and like looking back, it's like, I wish they hadn't been thrust into my life, you know, and honestly, more for their sake. You know, I was grateful for the moment that I was in the emergency room. One of my colleagues was there holding me, and it was the most precious friendship that I had here, you know, but that didn't last. That was something, you know, I think I had used up the emotional energy between the two of us, you know, because it's very few people can understand and have the emotional strength to support somebody who's grieving. And so, you know, unfortunately, I'm like, they had star roles in my grief story. My colleagues did, because that's all I had here. And so for me, they became like family, even the ones that didn't really care for me. I actually really cared for them because they had been there for me. You know, to me, that was my family. That was, you know, the good, the bad, the ugly, that was my family. And so that moment of feeling like everything I had worked for in my career didn't matter. I was no longer the scholar that I had worked so hard to be. And that's how I defined it, you know? And so, it took months and months and months of true grief for not only my husband, but then my career. Mm-hmm. And then kind of this, you know, it was this, my same friend who's been, you know, the rock from the start said, you know, you get to define yourself, Ashley, you get to be the one to write the story, you know, like, yes, they took something away from you. Yes, they prevented something that was so dear to you and so, you know, needed in your life. And, you know, yes, their actions don't mean you didn't deserve it, but it's done, you know, and you have like two options. You can accept that and move forward, or you can make a change. And to me, it was, I could just hear Buddy saying, like, you deserve to be valued and loved and cared for. And for me, it was really this kind of, I need to do that for myself and kind of redefine what worth means. What does success mean? Is it a publication? Because that sure didn't matter when he died. You know, is it, what I do in the classroom? Maybe, you know, my students are so precious to me, but I've served them, you know, and in some ways my biggest priority now is my daughter and I deserve the journey and the love and the pursuit of happiness and health. And in the, you know, with everything that had happened, my health and my happiness were at the bottom, you know, and my daughter would see me some days and she'd be like, is it work? Are you crying again because of work? And I'm like, yeah, sadly, this is because of work, you know? And so I think quarantine's been a blessing for me. It was one of those things that I finally got to the point that I was like, you know, he's right. I can either embrace what's happened or I can kind of redefine my life. And so I pushed forward really hard. The day after I had gotten the phone call of, you know, not getting this job back in September, October, whatever it was, I marched myself straight down to the court's office and I filed for a small business. And I said, I'm going to publish my own dang children's book. I'm going to be an indie author. I think that sounds so much cooler than self-published. But, you know, I was like, I'm going to be an indie author and I'm going to publish my own book. And Reagan has not only been the main character in that, but almost like this little seat, you know, creative officer with me, chief creative officer with me. And the joy and the magic we've created by not only this first book that's coming out, you know, later this year, but the series that we're creating. I've written multiple different books. Reagan has been the one that I asked, like, what should y'all do next? What should you and Fresno be doing next? And she's excited to sell the book with me, you know? And I'm like, I get to say what's valuable now. And for me, that's my happiness, my health. Success means pursuing that and trusting myself to pursue that. And so, yeah, quarantine's been one of those things. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you highlight the sort of like my own personal fascination with the rock bottom. You've given us such a beautiful, you know, peek behind the curtain of what it looks like, what it feels like, what it, you know, the ramifications, the domino effect and the realities really, but what is obviously there that of course isn't any kind of silver lining or even some kind of platitude like it was all meant to be, but it's a grand shakeup. And you're just coming out of that, you know, the whole thing gets tossed up in the air, right? Your whole life gets thrown up like confetti. And as it starts to come back down, it's rearranged in a new order. And that's not something that the times that it's happened to me, my own personal rock bottoms, I would have never invited them. I would have never, air quotes. Of course, I did make the choices. It wasn't death like this that's so out of my control. There were different things like, you know, my faith crisis or my divorce that of course were my choices, but air quotes, you know, I wouldn't have chosen for those moments to arrive on my plate. But the grand shakeup does offer some benefits and some new ways of being that you wouldn't have chosen, but through the long term, in the long run, do in some ways end up offering some gifts, as you highlight, taking this pivot with your children's book and deepening the relationship with your daughter and the partnership that you have. Will you leave us with? I'm wondering, through your grief academia, before you'd ever experienced a tragedy like this in your own life, and Reagan's her therapy through the group that you sent her to, are there any golden nuggets of wisdom or best practices or things that we can bring into our own life for grief or tragedy, big or small?
Yeah, absolutely.
Pandemic, yeah.
I think the biggest thing is something that I have held true to. It's there's such a need for families and individuals to grieve both for themselves, right? And to seek help individually, whether it's, there's no shame in medical help and intervention. If you need sleepy medicine or you need anxiety, depression medicine, this is a moment. And that might be a temporary fix or it might be a long-term fix. And neither is shameful, like our society, you know, tells us. But to definitely care for yourself, but to make sure that you also care as a unit and you grieve as a unit, because children need to know their parents hurt. Like you were talking about, spouses need to know their spouses hurting, those kinds of things. It makes our grief manageable by knowing that we're not the only ones feeling it, you know, and we might be feeling it differently, but to know that we're not alone in our grief is helpful. But to also make sure you do get that individual help. I think also allowing new traditions, like we put up, two Christmas trees, you know, since he passed away. And we have special ornaments that, you know, of course, remember Dad, but it's a lot of the ornaments for me, some of the things that bring back so much emotion are like videos of him or going through the ornaments for Christmas. That's hard for me because those are ornaments over 10 years that meant something to each moment of our life. You know, we'd pick up an ornament, but for Reagan, they're such precious memories. So I have to be mindful, like if she wants to watch videos of her dad, absolutely. But I kind of, you know, step back to the back because hearing his voice is too real for me. Doing the ornaments, I said, why don't you have a daddy tree or a tree of yours? And we can put that up in, you know, near your room. And that way I didn't have to be the one to be like, oh God, that's that ornament I got, you know, at this place. But I helped her put it up. You know, I went through the ornaments with her and kind of told her stories about her dad. But then it was kind of distant for me. Do you know what I mean? Where I was able to kind of build my own new tree and one that was kind of shabby chic in my, you know, in my new living room. And allowing yourself to have new moments and not feel guilt and shame. I think there's so much, especially as a widow, so much about, you know, I was at a barbecue once with a air quote friend who was talking to another person about, oh, their dad had moved on and was, you know, dating again only 3 months later. And I'm like, I spoke up and I said, you know, I think when you love, you want that love again, you know, and they're like, oh no, that means you don't love them. And they pretty much articulated a formula. And, you know, like if you loved them, you should wait at least this long. If you have a kid, multiply it by this and divide by, you know, this and square this. And I was sitting there going, none of you are widows. This blows my mind, you know, that to say if you loved, you could not love again, for some people could be true. But there
or why no weaponize way. Shame that their marriage might have been on the rocks? There are a lot of people probably speaking about divorce that one of them ends up dying. I want to make a joke about how that's all our dream, but that's probably inappropriate. Yeah, right?
No, but for me, Buddy and I had talked so seriously about, I think because I studied homicide, you know, and I would come home and say, like, God bless this, you know, young girl I met with, or, you know, her husband died or her boyfriend was killed or whatever. And we talked and he was like, Ashley, if something happens to me, like, you please don't be doing, like, laying in my coffin and, you know, mourning for me. He's like, you have a life to live and I want you to be loved fearlessly. I want you to be taken care of, you know, and, like, he would tease me. He's like, sorry, I was an educator too. You know, like, you know, I wish someone could take care of you. And, but promise me one thing, whoever it is, they love you and my daughter fearlessly, you know? And it was kind of this, just such a kind permission. And for him, he said, you know, of course, if you die, he's like, I'm dating a hot blonde and I will never get remarried because I like being, you know, independent. But he's like, you don't do good by yourself. You know, so, like, we had those sweet conversations. And I think, you know, people looking in, there is that, you know, and even now, I'm, you know, as I think about, like, you know, I want to love again, I will love again, and there will be a new chapter in my life. But there is the fear of, like, I don't want to hurt anyone in that process. Balancing a child is hard enough, but I have other people in my life. I have sister-in-laws that I love like my own family. I have his parents that are my second parents, you know, and I never want a new life to ever be something that, you know, takes away from takes away from the love that I had for Buddy. It's just, one's a chapter and I will never find a love like that again, but I will love again. And I think that's what's different, you know, like, I will love again. It doesn't mean I will love the same, you know, it's a new love. Yeah. And I think for Reagan as a child, same kind of thing, you know, it's like, she's told me before, like, I don't want a new dad, and, you know, step parents are bad. Right. You know, and she's laughing and I'm like, no, that's in Disney movies. Most step parents are not bad, you know, and she laughs, but it's like, there's a fear in her. You can tell, because even with friends of ours, she'll love on them, you know, and then she'll get in the car and she misses her dad. And, you know, she's like, I don't ever want a new dad. And you can tell the struggle she has even with friendships with men who are good to us. So I try to talk to her about, you know, our hearts are resilient. They grow, they don't shrink, you know, and daddy's love's always going to be there. Daddy's always going to be here. But he would also want us to love and be loved by anyone who wants to do that.
Well, that is beautiful. Where can people find you, Ashley?
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Well, the coolest place to find us is following our adventures, because Reagan and I are doing that together with Fresno. And I would, you can follow us at www.myfriendfresno.com. The book is actually available for pre-sale along with some other goodies with the book. We're also on Instagram and Facebook at myfriendfresno. And if they want to know a little bit more about me, I'm at ashleywellman.com.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing this with us today.
Thank you, Natalie. I hope that someone finds a little sparkle of something that sticks with them, and they know that each day you will get stronger and it does get better.
Thank you so much to Dr. Ashley Wellman for being with us and for sharing so generously of her most intimate moments of her life and her story. It was an honor to get to speak with her, and thank you so much for being with me on another episode of Your Spin Out is Gorgeous. Would you please connect with me on Instagram, TikTok, my website? I'm mostly at Natalie Q everywhere. On TikTok, I'm at Natalie.Q. My website is NatalieQ.com, where you can get your own personal 21-day habit replacement journal. Please connect with Ashley on her links. And I can't wait for her book to be out and to learn more and grow more with her, see where her journey unfolds. And thank you again so much for being here. We'll see you next week, where we will continue this discussion, speaking about the mother wound, continued by the father wound. And thank you again.